everyone, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Good People, a podcast brought to you by GoFundMe. I'm your host, Kelsey Little, and I could not be happier to be here bringing you another inspiring story. Before we dive into today's episode, I have an update for you. If you remember, in episode 6, we spoke with Jeff Liu, the incredible dad from Seattle who helped spark a national conversation about lunch debt in schools. Well, at the end of that episode, I gave Jeff a $5 bill. Actually, I borrowed it from my coworker, Kate, who was there with me, but don't worry, I paid her back. Thanks, Kate. I gave it to him with the condition that he had to use it to do something kind for someone else. He sat on it for a while, waiting for the right moment, and he finally emailed me recently to let me know that he found the perfect thing. He actually heard of another GoFundMe campaign started by a woman named Grandma Pat, as she's known on her popular Instagram account, and she was raising money to erase lunch debt too for a school in her area. Jeff was so touched by her spirit and enthusiasm, and so he donated that $5 to Grandma Pat's campaign to help end lunch debt for a school in California. Thanks for paying it forward, Jeff! All right, the story we have for you today is truly amazing. My guests, Caitlin and Eric, are dear friends, but they did not meet each other in a typical way. They are so grateful to have found each other, and the bond they share is so special. Some might even call their meeting fate. I am deeply honored to have them both here today to share their story with you. I'm here today at Baltimore Studios in Baltimore, Maryland, just arrived last night from San Diego, and I'm very excited to have Caitlin Smith and Eric McCoy in the studio with me today to share their amazing story. How you guys doing?
We're doing great.
We're doing good.
Good.
Doing good.
I can't thank you both enough for taking the time to speak with me today. So your story is particularly wonderful because it wasn't just a thing that happened and then ended. The events of last year clearly sparked a lasting friendship between the two of you. Caitlin, I remember reading that you called your meeting kismet. Some might call it fate, divine intervention, whatever you want to call it. But in its simplest form, the thing that sparked the two of you meeting was that Eric found your purse in an alleyway. However, that's not all there is to the story. Eric, would you mind telling us about what happened that day and what was going on in your life at the time?
That day, it was the month of June. It was June, month of June 2017. I had become homeless at the time, and my life just, it was a wreck. At that time, along with being homeless, I was unemployed. I actually had a job making $50 a day at a tire shop, and that money didn't last very long with having addiction. So, you know, every day I find myself living in this abandoned house, which there's tons of them in Baltimore. So next thing you know, I go out to get my fix, and I find myself in an alley afterwards, you know, going back there to get high. And went into a yard that was really overgrown because I didn't want to, you know, anybody to see me. And so as I got back there through the weeds and everything, I'm sitting there, and next thing you know, I look back behind me and I see a purse, and my first thought was that a female addict left their purse back here. And I didn't give it a second thought to even look in there, because if she left it, it wasn't going to be anything of value in it. But at the second glance of the purse, I'm like, well, that damn thing looks damn near brand new, and looks like it's a real like, yeah, can't be real, you know. It was actually a designer purse. So next thing you know, I'm like, okay, all right, open up, it's filled up with stuff. So I start going through the stuff, and I find a piece of paper with an address on it, along with all the things with her name on it. And at that exact time, you know, I came to a point in my life where I heard a voice was like, you got to give it back.
Wow.
You got to find the owner. And, you know, I don't know if it was because I was where the voice came from, because it was high or whatever, but that's what I did. I said, you know, that's what I'm going to do. So I started out on my mission across Baltimore. It would be that she lived all the way on the other side of Baltimore. Wow. I was over in West Baltimore, and she lived all the way over on East Side.
Did you just know the city that well? I mean, how did you plan to find her house with...
Well,
like, not a map or anything? Or did you have a map with you?
No, I didn't have a map. I didn't have a map at all. Basically, you know, I know a lot of the harder parts of Baltimore.
Yeah.
by street, by visual. I've been there. Her area, I really don't know that well. I was looking actually for somebody who would let me use their cell phone so I could look up the address. Okay. And I was having a really hard time, you know, because of the way I was looking. Homeless and all, nobody wants to, hey, here, you can use my cell phone.
Yeah.
So finally, I found the address and I made my way to the subway. I got a subway ticket and caught that over to the east side. Once I got off the subway on the east side, I was thinking to myself, like, man, okay. Even from the subway, it was just like I was walking for so long.
Yeah.
It was blocks and blocks and blocks, and I was just ready to give up. And I came upon a church, and the lady at the church was giving out, they were giving out lunches. And she saw me carrying this bag, and she actually was like, hey, let me see that bag. She actually almost pulled it off my shoulder. And she said, if I wasn't a good Christian, I'd buy this from you. So I'm like, wow, you know. And the funny thing is that even earlier than that, when I had originally first got off the subway, a block or two before I got to the church, there was a girl in a car who pulled over and offered to buy the purse from me.
Really?
Yeah. So that's two people within an hour's time trying to buy this purse. And
what do you think made you... I mean, that's probably like a quick solution. You wanted to get it to somebody or something. And what made you keep going and wanting to find the original owner?
The voice that I heard, it was, you know, maybe it was my inner conscious. Maybe it was God. I don't know. It just was a strong voice. Like, you know, just do the right thing, you know. And I was never raised to be that type of person anyway, you know. People change, you know, when drugs gets involved and stuff like that. We find ourselves doing things that we normally wouldn't do. And, you know, through the list of things that I found myself doing that I normally wouldn't do through my drug addiction, you know, I just didn't want that to be one of them. So, you know, I kept on my journey. And I actually had, like, a breakdown in it as I was walking, because I remember stopping and sitting on somebody's steps and shedding a couple tears because, you know, I had missed two opportunities to, you know, to sell a purse.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there thinking, like, I must be crazy to be doing this, you know. I'm homeless, don't have any money, and here's an opportunity to make some money, and I'm just going to just keep walking. I'm like, oh, man. So I came to my senses and straightened myself up and kept on the mission that I was going to return this purse. So I get close to her house, and I don't know. I said, it's in this area somewhere. And I ask a lady, getting out of her car, and she says, well, you passed it already. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I don't know how. I was just in a daze walking, really. So I walk back to her street, and I start walking down her street, and I look at the bill paper that I had with the address on there, and I look at where I'm at, you know, and, you know, the difference between the numbers was like, it was, I guess, in my head, I thought it was about 14 blocks, 15 blocks, and that's a long walk. That's still a long walk. So I asked the guy coming out of his house on her street for a cigarette, and he gave me a cigarette, and then I said, am I going, you know, the right direction?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, it's only two blocks up the street.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, how is that possible? We're on, you know, the 800 block, and, you know, hers is way, way up. It's in the 20-something. And I said to myself, "That how is that possible? And he said, because after you get to 800, it goes straight to 2,000.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. So, I was ecstatic, and I kept moving. Next thing you know, getting my bop on really hard, and I'm coming up the street. I want to get there quick because I'm tired.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I see about five ladies standing outside dressed really nice. And they had the whole sidewalk occupied. I didn't want to be, I know I was dressed ratty looking and just really looked like a disheveled person, dirty shirt on, dirty jeans. And I said, you know, I'm just going to cross the street, actually, and, you know, so I don't scare them or cause any issues or anything like that. So as I put my head down and started going across the street, I noticed one of them pointing at me and talking to her friend. And next thing you know, it's this next thing you know, Kate said, hey, you, hey, you, hey, you want to sell that purse? And I'm like, wow, this is the third person today that's offered to buy this purse. And I just politely told her, I said, ma'am, I'm sorry. I can't sell you this purse. I'm trying to find the owner of it. And she said, hey, I'm the owner. She said, wow. That purse belongs to me. And I was like, oh, my goodness. I'm like, finally. So it was like I gave her the purse, and she said, I said, well, I told her I'll see you later.
Yeah.
And she said that she wanted me to stay there, but she had to go. I waited 40 minutes for her, and the reason I stayed because she said she wanted to do something for me, you know, like, you know, buy me some lunch or give me a couple of dollars or something like that. So that's what made me stay. And when she came back, she did more than that. She had offered me a job, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, she said, I'm gonna help you out. You know, I'm give you some money to get yourself something to eat, and also, you know, give you a couple of dollars.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, thanks. And she said, well, you know, since you're homeless, don't you wanna you know, get off the street? Don't you wanna? I can give you a job making some money. And you know, I told her, yeah, I'll take the job. And I told her I'd take the job and that I'm interested in it. But reality to it was I really wasn't interested in it because, you know, I thought to myself, like, you know, this woman is being very nice to me. She gave me some money to get something to eat. She also gave me a big bag, like was a sleeping bag and some other stuff in there, clothes in there. And then I just decided to tell her the truth because I didn't want her to waste her time with the job thing and then think that I'm going to show up and then me wake up and be sick from the drugs and not show up to work. And I just told her, I said, you know what, I'm just going to be honest with you. I don't want to accept a job from you because I'm probably not going to show up for work. And she said, why not? And I told her, because I'm a heroin addict. And she said, oh, I think we could do something about that. Let's do something about that.
Before we get too deep into what happened next, because that is an incredible story, could we rewind a little bit to when you lost your purse, Caitlin?
Yeah.
Did you think you were ever going to see it again? And then what was it like seeing Eric walk up the street with it on his arm?
Yeah, sure. So there were so many things that had to happen to get my purse stolen, which is why I feel like this whole thing is divine intervention, because I had gotten keys copied that weekend. And so I happened to have keys in my glove box in my car to my house. And so it was a Sunday night. I had packed up my purse and had it sitting right on the counter with all my work stuff in it. And Monday morning, I was like, am I going crazy? Where's my bag? You know, and I guess someone had let themselves in my back door because that's when I noticed that my car had been broken into.
Oh, my gosh.
So I guess my dog scared him off, but they did grab the purse off the counter. And so I went through canceling all my cards and everything, but I didn't even bother filing a police report because I didn't think I'd ever see the bag again.
Yeah.
And, you know, 4 days later, I was walking to a friend's house with some pizzas to surprise her on her birthday. And, you know, when I saw Eric, I was standing with my roommate and said, Katie, that's my purse. That guy is my purse. And so when I met Eric, he was just like he described. I mean, he wasn't looking good. He looked sick. And I asked him, you know, if he would wait for me because I was going to go drop these pizzas off and then come back and sort of collect my thoughts. But I took the bag and had him wait near my house. And a neighbor was like, hey, there's, you know, a druggie on the front steps of your house. I'm going to call the cops. And I was like, no, I know him. Yeah. Don't do anything. So, but it just goes to show, you know, how out of place he was, A, and B, kind of some stigmas that maybe we need to talk about and work on as a community, you know. I came back, talked to Eric. He said he wasn't going to be able to take the job because he didn't feel he would be able to – he thought he would let me down. And he didn't mention it, but he had told me that his sleeping bag had been stolen out of the abandoned house he was living in, and that's kind of what motivated him to – returned the bag to me because he had been a theft victim himself. and felt kind of violated. And so he's like, that's I can horrible. Imagine you were missing your bag. So I asked him if he wanted a ride back, and we drove back to West Baltimore. So I dropped him off and kind of gave him my card and said, you know, I'd like to give you this money for tonight, because he had been honest about that he was going through withdrawals and probably needed to get a fix that night. Right. Yeah. So I was like, well, here's my number. If you're serious about going to treatment, I'll help you. And I was shocked that he called on Saturday, 2 days later.
Wow.
He was like, hey, I don't know if you remember me. I'm like, yeah, I do.
So how did that whole experience go? How did you select the place that he ended up going to?
Yeah, so this is kind of an important topic because I think a lot of people with addiction or the loved ones of people with addiction get into crisis mode because sometimes people with addiction aren't ready to go to treatment or don't appreciate how much the addiction has affected their life. So they might have all these circumstances going on and still not be attributing it to the drugs or alcohol, because the symptoms of addiction, I've learned, are really similar to symptoms of other types of mental health disorders. So there's often a dual diagnosis, because if you're not honest with your primary care physician or whoever you're seeing about your addiction, then your behaviors could look like bipolar, could look like depression, could look like anger issues. You know, I'm not an expert at the clinical aspect, but I have learned that a lot of times there's a dual diagnosis is really common, and people who are suffering with the disease, it's really like a disease that affects the brain. And as Eric said, like, your personality changes, your brain chemistry is affected when you're under the influence. And so you're really not even the same person as you are when you're not addicted. So I was shocked that Eric called me Saturday morning and said, I do want to go to treatment. I have a daughter that I love, and I'm missing out on her life, and I'm missing time with my family and my nieces. And
let me jump in real quick.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. The part where actually when finding me a treatment, she probably remember, she had asked me to, she said, well, if you can find a place, you know, I'll get you there and I'll stick with you, you know? So, when I spoke to her on Saturday, when I got off the phone with her, I started doing some research, and I found the place that would take the insurance that I had at the time. But it was in Florida, and wow. I didn't have any means of getting there. So I called her back and told her that I found a place. And, you know, she's like, well, all right, we'll get you there, and we'll start this thing. We'll start, you know, getting your life together. So next thing you know, she says, all right, I looked on the internet, and you're going to fly out in about, shit, it's like 10 days or something like that.
Yeah, I saw. Wow. I was on Southwest and just looking at, you know, casually looking at flights. And I was like, how does this flight in 2 weeks look? Looks like it's a good time, because the intake people at the facility that he had found said that if he got to the airport between 9 and 5 any weekday, that they could pick him up. So I was like, how does this flight sound? And he said, I think I'm going to die this week.
Oh, my gosh.
He said, I think I feel like something really bad's going to happen to me this week. So that was a Saturday before Father's Day. Yeah. And
why did you feel that way?
I felt that way because I had been going through a lot of, how should I put it? Life-threatening situations. Mm-hmm. Baltimore is one of the only cities that sells a type of heroin that they sell in Baltimore. It's only sold here. They call it Scramble, and
it's got fentanyl in it.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's heroin, it's benzos, and it's fentanyl mixed together.
Wow!
And obviously, there's no dosages, you know, right. So people can die from the stuff. And so he I guess felt between that and the fact that he was living in an abandoned house that was kind of a
that's what I was also going to say too about the abandoned house that I was living in. A lot of abandoned houses, they become stash spots.
Oh.
The ones that aren't dilapidated and falling apart. They become stash spots for the people in the neighborhood who are selling narcotics. So this particular house that I was staying in, I would only go there at nighttime. And it just so happened this one day, like right before I had, I think it was like the day before I ran into Kate, day before I met Kate, one of the dealers, you know, had threatened my life.
Oh my gosh.
And he basically told me, get my stuff and get the heck out of that stash house because, you know, I don't know if he was using it as an excuse or whatever, but he told me that, you know, their stuff was missing. And I had no idea. I'll be honest with you. At that time, I was an addict. If I had found anything in that house, you know, I would have known to get up out of there quicker than a little bit. But I didn't take anything out that house. And
it's a scary situation to be in.
Yeah, it was dangerous. And so he said, I have this bad feeling that something bad's going to happen to me this week. So I said, all right, how's Monday morning? So he was like, I'll probably be able to find a ride. I was like, have you been through TSA recently? Like, do you know the check-in situation with the kiosk? Have you ever used a kiosk? Like, I was like trying to think through the things that were going to get him jammed up. But
I had a trash bag. I come out the house on Monday morning with a trash bag.
And I'm like, oh, this is going to be a TSA nightmare.
Oh, no.
You know? And so, fortunately, he was able to find a duffel bag and transfer things in there because I don't know how we would have been able to navigate with the...
That would have been a little tricky, probably.
Yeah. But he got to spend Sunday with his daughter, Father's Day, with his daughter. Yeah. And then Monday morning, I picked him up. We had, bizarrely, his first ever banana.
Really?
Do you remember that? We stopped at a 7-Eleven, and I was like, do you need some, like, toiletries or, you know, anything like that? So we got him deodorant, a Gatorade, and a banana. And he was like, I've never had a banana before. And some nuts. I was like, eat some of this. So he had his first banana, so that was cool. And then we drove to the airport. I remember you saying something like, we're going to be something. Like, we're going to do something someday.
Yes, I remember telling her that, you know, for some reason I felt like this is something great's going to come out of this. You know, I told her that before I got out the car, and so I get on the flight, I get down there to Florida, and next thing you know, she said, I got a surprise to tell you, and I'm like, what? What's going on? She's like, well, I wanted to surprise you when you come back. I had opened up a GoFundMe page, and I had just ran it past some of the people in my neighborhood. Next thing you know, she's like, I didn't know it was going to be like this, but it's got over $5,000 into her already. So I was like, are you serious?
Well, that might be all he remembers from treatment, but I remember. I dropped him off at the airport, and I thought, this is the last time I'm going to see this dude. But it was nice, like nice little life experience happened.
That's
I learned.
What you thought, huh?
Yeah. I'm 0% chance I'm ever going to see this guy again. You know, like, see ya. Bye. Good luck at TSA. Kiosks, like trying to go over, like, here's your confirmation number.
Right. I remember.
Yeah, but. But he got down there, they take your phone, they take your shoelaces, they take everything. And so I was really surprised that he called me every day from treatment. We didn't talk about that. I mean, I didn't expect to hear from him, but he would wait in line for like an hour to talk to me for 10 minutes on the phone. And I could hear him getting better. I could hear him getting clearer and more vibrant. And he is very spiritual, which really inspires me because, you know, I grew up going to church, but I kind of haven't been in my adulthood as much. And we would have these very spiritual conversations about maybe why we were brought together and just trying to learn about each other and in short 10-minute segments. Yeah. Like, Eddie, I'm getting off the phone. Give me 5 more minutes, you know, or whoever. So it was, but yeah, I could really like, I was really getting to know him. And then he was there for 37 days. And near the end, kind of like a week or two before he was discharged, he was like, Kate, I'm not sure how I'm going to pay for next steps. AA recommends 90 days and 90 meetings. And he had gone to, you know, 37 days and 37 meetings. But he's like, I'd like to do the 90 days and 90 meetings. And I kind of at that point really wanted to see him through that goal,
absolutely,
that kind of short-term goal. So yeah, that's when we kind of thought about what are some options. You know, I had some friends who were willing to donate, you know, a couple outfits and this or that. But I was like, I'm going to just try this GoFundMe campaign. You know, I've seen inspiring stories on GoFundMe before. And
yeah, I kind of jumped the gun. I went straight to the
yeah, no, I mean, I was like, you know, let's try this. So I kind of wrote up a little thing about what we had been through. And my neighborhood group, Facebook group, has all the neighbors around Patterson Park, probably a couple thousand people. And we share frequently about, you know, couches for sale, yeah, or someone's dog is roaming around the park, or I was mugged at this corner, or I was hijacked here. I mean, it happens. Yeah. But
people go over to that side of town to do dirt, you know, because like,
because, you know, everyone you stop is probably going to have something on them.
Yeah.
You know?
If you rob somebody on the west side of Baltimore, you know, you could just be practicing.
Wow.
You could just wind up being practicing because you're probably not going to get anything. You know, but definitely a lot of things happen over in Kate's area because, mm-hmm, you know, people.
It's more targets, I guess. So,
Easier targets.
So anyway, unfortunately, like, we share a lot to the Facebook group about kind of negative things, you know, about theft and crime. And so I shared this story to Patterson Park neighbors thinking, like, you know, hey, here's a good story about something that happened after a crime took place. And, you know, people were really quick to
jump the gun a little bit on something.
Well, no, people were really quick to not only share the story, but donate. And we were both overwhelmed with how many people could relate and shared personal stories.
Wow.
It seems like addiction affects 1 in 4 families.
Yeah.
And when you think of it that way, I mean, we had hundreds of people emailing us through the GoFundMe site, mm-hmm, sharing personal stories, or, you know, this reminds me of my son who I lost, or this is, you know, I feel like this is me 10 years ago,
wow,
or, you know, this really spoke to our family. We took this as an opportunity to educate our daughters about some of the topics that you guys, you know, have talked about. I mean, this,
wow,
very generous family donated like $1,200 because they saw it as a really important life lesson to their daughters. So GoFundMe has been an incredible vehicle for kind of not only, you know, being a vehicle for this particular campaign, but also like a very unifying platform.
I think that a lot of people in the beginning were skeptic of me as a person. I say that because in the beginning, you know, you have a person who is from the rougher part of town. You know, this guy just miraculously returns your purse to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're doing all this nice stuff for him. And, you know, maybe a couple people thought that maybe, you know, she was getting taken advantage of, you know, even to the point where some people were saying that it's possible that I'm the one who broke into her house and even
horrible
and stole a purse, you know, and now I'm just running another form of a con or game on her.
What does it feel like to have people just assume those things about you without even knowing you?
It hurt, but it was more so. I've actually went to jail for something that I didn't do before, in the past.
That's awful.
So it was not only it kind of hurt, but more so than that, I was scared because what if, not to say that it would happen, but what if, you know, these people, you know, got into Kate's ear to the point where she changed her direction instead of helping me, decide to say, you know what? You know, I don't want anything to do with you. I think you were the one who did it. You know, imagine the outcome would have been if she had thought that. You know,
but she did. I mean, in my heart, in my mind, I didn't think Eric. I never really thought about that. But there were a few friends of mine who pointed it out that it was a possibility. And even if it was a possibility, I mean, the whether he took the purse, he was still returning it, right? So,
so actually, in the whole thing with that, with the maybe somebody possibly thinking that I was the culprit, I think that as far as GoFundMe is concerned, she started the campaign, and I think that a lot of people maybe who were skeptic, when she came out and told everybody, she had a certain friend of a friend who was a police officer who was just hellbent. Like, he did it.
He had been a corrections officer.
Oh, gotcha.
And so he was just, again, coming from a different perspective and saying, like, this is a scam that's common, that people steal something, they know who the owner is, and they return it to them, and they get you on both sides. Yeah. And so that was a possibility, right?
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that I think that as far as the GoFundMe campaign is concerned, I think that when the police found the person who actually had broken into her house.
I was at my parents' house, and I got a call from a detective. And he asked if – he was asking some fishy, you know, fishing around questions. And I was like, I'm sorry, can I ask, you know, what the call's for?
Yeah.
And he asked if I had been the victim of a theft recently, and that my belongings had been found among the belongings of, like, 8 or 9 other people at a gentleman's house who was a suspect for – many thefts, and he was in custody. So the guy said, the detective said, you know, unfortunately, we can't use your case or your property in the charges against this guy because you didn't file a police report.
Oh.
But you can pick up your stuff at the police station. So with the exception of my phone and iPad, I got all my stuff back, including,
awesome.
You know, the purse and this whole new perspective.
That's amazing.
But yeah, so it ended up being really nice, and it just felt like we got these little gifts or blessings along the way that reminded us that we were on the right path together.
I love that so much.
And so yeah, that's another caveat is another month later, Eric was, I think, living at the halfway house at this point, and my dad called on a Sunday morning, and he had just been to church. And my parents, I grew up in New Jersey. My parents relocated to Charleston for retirement like 2.5 years ago. So I had mentioned I grew up going to this Catholic church around the corner from my house. My parents now are living in Charleston, and my dad's going regularly to church. My mom hadn't been going, my dad calls on a Sunday morning to tell me that the homily was about me and Eric.
Wow.
That this priest in Charleston, South Carolina, was, you know, giving his sermon and kind of transitioned into a homily about sharing your gifts. And here's the story about Caitlin and Eric in
That's
Baltimore.
Amazing.
And my dad's, you know, standing in the back of the room like, what is going on?
Wow.
You know? And, you know, introduced himself to the priest at the end of the mass.
Oh, the priest didn't know that?
No.
No.
It was just a complete random.
Wow.
Yeah. And so my dad went home and told my mom, and now my mom's been going back to church. So for me, there was like these little gifts along the way that were kind of like you're validating, you know, like you're doing the right thing with the right person. And then it was, I don't know, the whole, I think the cool thing about us is like we were obviously strangers, but we've had this unusual accountability to each other. I think because we're strangers that each step of the way was kind of like, well, I guess I'm down to do this if you're down to do it. Like,
right.
If I take this step, will you do this? And like,
right.
We kind of just, like, we're accountable to each other. And
it got us this far. You
yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
And on, like, when people started hearing about this story, it kind of went a little viral, I would say.
It absolutely did.
Next thing you know, I'm sitting out in front of a halfway house that I just got into talking to Channel 7 News.
Wow.
Down in Florida. And then I came back to Baltimore. And next thing you know, I'm on WBAL for Baltimore. And then, you know, a lot of different people were giving calls interested in the story. And I think as the story got out there, that even drew us closer together because we were now in the light of people who could support and help us, you know?
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you actually, you know, so there's always going to be cynical people like we talked about, but I believe that for every one cynical person, there's 100 others who want to help. So what was it like seeing that GoFundMe campaign and seeing all those people all over the country and all over the world want to pitch in to help you and your life?
Okay, so one thing that you lose in active addiction is your will. You lose your will to want for better things. You lose your will power to control the addiction. And you kind of almost lose your will to live. So that's one thing that goes. The next thing that goes is hope. Once the hope starts to go, you know, you're in a full downward spiral. And the only thing that can pull you back out of that spiral is to get your hope back. And after you get your hope back, then you can work on getting your willpower to be stronger back. So seeing all these people wanting to help me gave me hope back. With Caitlin sticking by me through the rough patches. Now, this is a story that has rough patches in it. It's not all good. I can say that there was times where, you know, she was frustrated with the situation because it's a lot to put on a person who, you know, she's working a full-time job. And on top of that, she's being my advocate as far as navigating through the issues that it takes to support a person, to help a person get strong enough to stand on her own 2 feet. Having her support and having the support of all these people who I've never even met before, you know, it gave me hope back. So I can say that it felt great to have so many people giving me hope back in my life.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I think for me, I didn't really have an appreciation for all of the challenges that we would encounter or all the gaps we would have to bridge.
Yes.
Going through this process together. So my
on the phone for hours.
My motivation for the campaign was really just to get him through his first 90 days. And I was considering, you know, rent, incidentals, food. And, you know, that would kind of be the 90 days. I am not in recovery. I haven't had addiction. So I don't, I didn't have an appreciation for kind of all the effort it takes after you've gone through treatment to maintain your sobriety in recovery. It really does take a lot of effort. So the campaign for me was an opportunity to be able to help Eric see him through his 90 days. And I was, you know, I think we were both so surprised and grateful to what the outpouring of support we got through GoFundMe from,
people we've never met. How much did it end up raising in total?
So currently it's at about 15,000.
Wow. That's huge.
Yeah. And it's almost been about a year, and we've been posting updates about our time together, but, reflecting, I know we've both, kind of thought about how there were these stumbling blocks that, I didn't post about all the details. Like Eric said, there were rough patches, and you know, one of them was
We didn't post about the $1,700 needed the day I got out of the rehab, because I show up at Walgreens with prescriptions, you know, for my mental health, for my substance abuse. And when I got out of the rehab, they, like, hand me a book of prescriptions, like, take these to a pharmacy and then go to your halfway house.
He's got 37 days of sobriety.
Yeah.
He's got a bag full of prescriptions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think maybe more care could have been put into the discharge planning of this, but he had made me an emergency contact. I wasn't able to reach anyone at the facility the whole time he was there. And so he was discharged without access to prescriptions. I think me on my end, I would have made the assumption that that would be kind of a continuum of care piece that would be more thoughtfully laid out by a clinician. So it's kind of confusing because the treatment for addiction has to start with a medical aspect to it. You know, you can die from withdrawal symptoms from certain substances. And so you have to be, you know, medically stabilized. And so, you know, having prescriptions on the back end is really common. You can't just, you can't really medically detox and stabilize someone
without without prescriptions. And that's where the campaign came in, because, you know, without the $1,700 needed for the prescriptions, what were we going to? What would you have done?
These were unanticipated costs, at least on my end. I was thinking rent, incidentals, food. But then he called me at 3 on the day. He was discharged, saying, like, I can't get my prescriptions filled. They're saying it's going to be $1,000 to fill my prescription, or
just one of them.
Or they said we can give you 2 days worth for $700. I remember Eric saying, "Don't worry, Kate. Like, I'll get the 2 days worth." And I'll taper myself off. And I'm like, you know, but it's a little humorous now that I have more insight on how long it takes, really. Like, recovery is forever.
Yeah.
So it's not just like an acute scenario that you're in where you've like fall and break your arm and you go in and get it stabilized and then you kind of heal on your own. Like, this is a mental health disease. And so it needs to be treated medically, but also it needs to be treated with counseling and fellowship. You know, you really need to be attending meetings for the longevity of your life, because it's one of those diseases that can be in remission, you know, kind of air quotes. Like, it can be in remission. Mm-hmm. You could be in recovery. But then you could think like, oh, well, I'm feeling better. I don't need to go to meetings anymore. Or, you know, I think I could have a drink and be able to moderate it now that I'm in a better place, right. You know. But it's one of those diseases that, like, you get lazy about the maintenance and like Eric said, the willpower it takes to overcome the disease. And this is a disease that's like doing push-ups in like the back of your brain the whole time. So the second there's an opportunity for the disease to kind of –
the gorilla comes out and jumps right on your back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where the term a monkey on the back comes from.
Yeah. So I think the, you know, campaign for me initially started with getting him through his 90 days. Then I was like quickly kind of shocked into the fact that it would be a lot more expensive to kind of get him back up and running between – figuring out, I mean, this was hours on the phone with you know, insurance companies to try to get his prescriptions covered, and then, you know, rent at the halfway house, food. And then I remember one of the things that I've learned through Eric through this campaign is, you know, we had to work together on a budget. You know, we had this GoFundMe money, and we were like, how are we going to use this so that we make it very productive and, and do these people proud, you know?
Yeah.
And so I remember Eric calling me and saying, like, hey, I mean, I know it's a little frivolous, but I don't feel like myself in these clothes. They've been given to me by other homeless people. These shoes have been given to me by other homeless people. Like, I don't feel like I'm myself at all. Would you mind if I took, like, $100 to buy myself a new pair of shoes? And, like, I have a couple cheap T-shirts in my hand. I'm over at TJ Maxx near the. Yeah. And he's like, I feel like I just need these things to feel like I have an identity again. And I was totally in support of him spending the money that way. And like, Eric is so cheap. Oh my God. It's like, a couple times I was like, please, you know, get yourself something better to eat than, like, he's just such a bargain hunter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm really happy that I'm working with someone who's so frugal, because, you know, there were plenty of opportunities where I think that he, you know, he doesn't touch this money. Like, this is like his holy grail of things that he saves for really, really special things. And so, like, I'm really passionate about this campaign and what we've done and what we're going to do because of how much I've learned through this process. Eric kind of alluded to some of the changes I've made personally, but I actually, I had been a medical device rep. And when I met Eric and I knew nothing about treatment, there had been instances in my life, loved ones and neighbors and friends who had been affected by addiction. So I'd kind of seen it. But
just from the outside.
Yeah. It was the first time that I'd actually been, you know, actively in sort of crisis mode working with Eric. And so, you know, I've learned a ton about it. I've become really passionate about, you know, like Eric talked about. You know, yeah, he's a 37-year-old man, smart guy. But when you're 37 days into recovery, you're not able to get your prescriptions. You have a thought like Eric had about, I can, you know, he's like, I'm a drug addict, Kate. Don't worry, I can taper myself off. I'm like, well, this is, you know, and then Eric himself said that there were people who would you know, leave treatment and then be back a week later because they would, you know, the treatment would come to an end with what was covered under their insurance policy. Yeah. They would be discharged
To
make space for another person to come in.
That would be hard.
And there's, you know, and then he's kind of like out on the front steps with a bag of scripts that need to be filled and really no,
a bag of prescriptions that need to be filled, and not a clue on how to get anything done.
There needs to be a lot of structure. He had like a phone, but I think didn't have the phone charger. Like there were so many little things that I think, from my perspective, I,
there's a lot of things that people. One thing I could say, like a lot of things people overlook, like you expect certain things from a person, you know. You wouldn't, you know, expect to have to worry about, you know, how you're going to get in contact with a coworker or friend, because you pretty much think, well, you know, this is 2018. They got a car. They have a cell phone. You know, they have means to finances. They have a house, you know. And, you know, a lot of things when you're dealing with a person in recovery, a person coming off the streets, you know, the little things are not there. So you could say, you know, our plan is to get you into a place, get you a job, you know, get you saving some money and get you back on track. But then, all right, first off, you got to find housing, okay? All right, second off, you got to find a job. But before you can find a job, you got to find transportation, you know?
There's a lot of these things that we, like, I take for granted every day. And, like, I mean, for example, Eric has really bad vision. And I don't know if you wear glasses, but I know that I have a very light astigmatism and I can notice when I'm not wearing my glasses. And he had really bad eyesight. He really needed glasses. But, I mean, he couldn't even... to address that need until his basic needs were met. I mean, I take for granted the fact I can just call Lens Crafters, make an appointment or wherever. But I mean, there were just basic things that were not in place. And so when someone leaves recovery, there really has to be like a structured year planned out. And what's sad is the stigma that's attached to this disease, because there are other diseases that, you know, when you're like in remission, there is, you know, rehab, there's emotional support groups, there's all these things. Those things are in place, are available to people with addiction, but there's, because of the stigma, access to them is much more difficult, access to information, finding the support systems that you need. So as someone who's 37 days clean, doesn't, you know, have the means, doesn't even have a phone that's fully charged.
Or working.
Yeah, so I mean, we use the GoFundMe money, people's generosity. I mean, I was sending Ubers from my app in Baltimore. I was getting him picked up and dropped off to get his prescription filled. I mean, the logistics of just getting him the basic elements that he needed to get the housing paid for, taking care of the transportation, getting food.
Even as far as getting back and forth to doctor's appointments.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, having to pay for the glasses.
Right.
I don't have, funny thing, I left them in the car. paying for the glasses, paying for Uber to put in to get to go to the first appointment where they set it up for you to get the glasses.
It's just things that we take for granted is the point. Like, you know, things that I didn't even anticipate when I started the campaign became issues and became reasons we were so grateful for the campaign later on, because we had some of these resources to be able to get the basic structure in place that he needed to be successful in recovery. So, I think that's been one of the biggest lessons for me, is that when you're so far removed from it, I mean, I hadn't given addiction or treatment a first thought until I met Eric. And now I'm kind of so entrenched in it that I've changed careers. And
could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I left medical device sales, which, you know, I had a great job with a great company, a pension plan.
All the bells and whistles.
Yeah, all the bells and whistles. Great company, great opportunity. But I found myself like in the evenings and on weekends trying to meet with other people who had who wanted to get involved in helping people with addiction, or trying to find resources so that I could respond to some of the people who had been emailing me asking, like, I don't know, people must have thought that I was some sort of you know, that I knew things that they didn't know, but I was frantically searching, like many other people are, for answers.
They thought she is the holy grail to me. I had a lot of people asking for help too. Yeah. You know, like can you do what you did for Eric, for me? You know,
and I have like this whole folder here is just like stuff that I've picked up that I carry with me of different types of treatment programs that are available for people with insurance, without insurance. You know. Medicare and Medicaid, like there are facilities that have different offerings, but I felt, you know, like it was my duty to sort of get some information and get it organized so that I was in a position to help people. And then I was fortunate to, through a mutual friend, another little nugget of divine intervention on this journey, met a friend who had a former sorority sister who works in treatment, addiction treatment, and we met for coffee. And 6 months later, a month and a half ago, I accepted a job with a company that's 8 residential treatment facilities for substance and alcohol abuse.
Wow! Ooh. And congratulations!
Thanks. So I'm a treatment consultant in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, and you know, I go around and work with clinicians, mental health professionals. You know, attorneys, community groups, Department of Health, like really anyone who has a program for addiction or doesn't have a program for addiction and needs some options for patients that they see or clients that they see. So I go around and try to network with people who would be in a position to, or, you know, someone would come to them and say,
her whole entire life.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's in this.
That is,
yeah.
When I say she's in this, she's in this. This is not a fly-by-night operation, people. She is the real deal, you know? She is the real deal. And it's like how your life is going to turn out, you know?
Amen.
Yes. It's just like how she said, like, drop off at an airport, see you later, you know? A year later, we're sitting here talking about life on life terms. We're sitting here talking about what really happens. And...
Well, more importantly, we were talking about walking in here, like what we can do about it, you know?
Yeah, so now you got to understand, she didn't just sit back and talk about it, you know? You know, we're in here talking now about real things that are happening, real actions that have taken place. I mean, this woman has changed her whole entire life, you know, and is deep into this recovery and helping people.
That's so beautiful. So... kind of as final thoughts or to close out, I wanted to ask both of you. So our podcast is called True Stories of Good People, and I think you're both very good people. It's clear to me. And I'd love to ask you this question. What does it take to be a good person toward others? Whatever that means to you in your heart. Eric, would you like to start?
A good person. I'd like to start and say that we as... humans were born innocent, and throughout our lives, we get touched by different situations that mold us. The thing is, in order for a person to be called a good person, you have to keep in the right direction of your moral compass. And your moral compass cannot be flawed from the beginning, because God says that we are all right through our own eyes. So basically, what I do in my own actions, I can see these as right. So in order to be called a good person, you have to let your moral compass be guided by the things that not only you as a person, but society knows to be good things and good deeds. You know, you're riding down the street and you see a person standing there holding a sign, you know. What does your moral compass tell you? Is to say, you know, that person's a scammer. That person, I make $80,000 a year. I make $40,000 a year. I make $150,000 a year. You don't even want to hand them a dollar, because you think that that person could be scamming you. In reality, it's really a homeless person, you know, or a person standing out there with mental illness or even addiction. And you can probably go back and say to yourself, well, you know, with the addiction thing, you know, 9 times out of 10, that person's probably going to spend the money on drugs. I want to give that person a dollar for that one time where they need to eat. I'm not going to be the person to be the judge, jury, executioner. You know, I'm going to do what my moral compass says to do and do unto others as I would want them to do to me.
What about you, Caitlin?
Well, I have a story about a good person, this guy named Eric, who, you know, he returned my purse, but that wasn't like an isolated incident. So I think I want to point out about good people that it's like a body of work. I mean, all of us mess up and have road rage sometimes and like, you know, say things we don't mean and you can't be perfect all the time, you know, but I think what's interesting to point out about Eric is, you know, he had been a landscaper, was in a car accident, was prescribed Percocet for his back injuries, went to treatment initially, but had always been kind of at risk, I guess, because of, you know, environment, family history. I mean, addiction is very much a family disease. I have some of it in my family. But, you know, Eric has dealt with addiction for most of his life. You know, some of the instances that happened, like being prescribed Percocet, going to treatment for the first time, coming back, mm-hmm. getting MRSA through a cut in his knee when he worked at Jiffy Lube, getting prescribed Percocet again. So, you know, but through all that, like, one of the things that was, you know, sweet to me is, you know, Eric heard this voice that told him to return the bag to me. But that was, you know, not the first time Eric's done a good deed. When we got him back home to Baltimore, he was contacted by a missionary that he used to work with, doing good things for other people at another time in his life. And Eric had pawned his landscaping equipment to pay for drugs a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And a missionary who he worked with, again, doing good things, had bought it out of the pawn shop for him and saved it for 2 years and stored it for him. So we actually bought back his original landscaping equipment from a guy who bought it from the pawn shop.
Yeah.
And I mean, you don't have things like that happen if you do one good thing one time in your life. So I think my message to people who want to do good in the world is that, like, it has to be like a practice, like you would practice yoga or practice religion or practice friendship. I mean, like, you won't, if you're not a good friend of people, like, you're not going to have any friends. If you're not seeing opportunities to do good things in the world, then you probably have a negative perspective. And so Eric talked a little bit about that, about people will look at a situation, and I'm guilty of it too, of someone standing on the side of the road and making judgment calls about how that person got there. If Eric didn't happen to be carrying my purse when I saw him, we wouldn't have had that conversation. So all of this is obviously rooted in good deeds, but I think the common thread is our humanity and our compassion for each other. He was compassionate towards me before we met about this poor girl lost her purse. You know, I want to return it to her because I was the victim of a theft and that didn't make me feel good. And that's where I think the line is between good people and bad people. I mean, I think that you have to be steadfast in your expectation for other people, but also for your expectation for yourself. You talked about moral compass to kind of like fight the urge to see everything in a negative way, even when you're purse gets stolen from you, mm-hmm. to try to fight the urge to want to do something negative or affect someone else in a negative way because of that kind of contagious nature of both good deeds and bad deeds.
Right.
But I think that if you can, you know, be contagious in a positive way, and both of us have impacted each other through GoFundMe. We've impacted other people, hopefully inspired other people to see, like people like Eric described, or people like Eric looked in the beginning, to see them for, you know, their story and their person. And it didn't take me anything to take 20 minutes to get to know Eric's story and feel compassion for him and be able to relate on a lot of different levels. And I mean, we come from completely different backgrounds, and I consider Eric to be one of my closest friends. So I think if I have something to say to people who want to, you know, do good and be good, it's, you know, don't be discouraged when negative things happen. Try to find the positive, the silver lining. Eric and I talk about the silver linings of things all the time. And I think don't live your life like it's a dress rehearsal for some future life. I mean, this is it. I mean, so to say like, oh, next time I'd like to stop and help that person, or next time I'm going to remember to bring a dollar with me, or offer someone a job, or, you know, go comfort someone who looks like they're upset, and, you know, like, you know, just do it. It's not like a practice round. Like, this is the time. And yeah, and I think don't be afraid to get involved and get your hands dirty. I mean, people thought I was crazy for putting Eric in my car and driving him back to his house. I mean, no offense, but at the time I thought I could easily take him.
She probably could.
You weren't looking that good.
At that time, I think I was a buck 20 soaking wet.
Yeah.
And that's what probably closer to a buck.
Yeah. But I mean, look at how, you know, much I got out of this. So when you say yes to certain things, yeah, you're saying no to other things. But in this case, like saying no to Eric or being willing to help him, like it would have closed me off to this whole other life that I'm about to start living. And hopefully this, you know, population of people with addiction who Eric and I want to try to get more involved in helping, and hopefully we can find our niche. We're trying to figure out some solutions for housing and transportation that we ran into struggles with housing and transportation. And so I think that's like a very common struggle for people that were in Eric's situation. So I think we're going to try to focus our efforts in helping people get rehabilitated after treatment.
If that story didn't stick with you, I don't know what will. I'm so happy that Caitlin and Eric have each other, and so thrilled you were able to hear their experience today in their own words. You can learn more about their story by visiting Caitlin's GoFundMe campaign for Eric at gofundme.com/the-real-McCoy. That's McCoy with two C's. And thank you so much for listening to True Stories of Good People, a podcast brought to you by GoFundMe. If you've been enjoying these stories, please make sure to subscribe, rate us, and most importantly, leave a review. It helps more people find our podcast. You can learn more about this episode by visiting gofundme.com/podcast. Also, we love to hear from listeners, so if you have any feedback, suggestions, or questions, you can write to us at podcast@gofundme.com. Lastly, for more True Stories of Good People content, you can follow us on Instagram at True Stories of Good People and on Twitter at TSGPPod. We'll be back next time with more True Stories of Good People. Talk to you then!